If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Before we get started, we want to tell you a bit about the sponsor of this week's History Extra podcast, Warner Hotels. If you're looking to escape to a picturesque corner of the UK for a few days, Warner Hotels has just the thing for you. Each hotel offers everything you could possibly need for the perfect weekend away. From unrivaled leisure facilities and inspiring live entertainment to delicious dining experiences and plenty of history for you to uncover. If this sounds like your kind of getaway, Warner Hotels is now offering a series of exciting weekend packages in 2024. Each three-night stay is at one of three historic hotels, with dinner, bed and breakfast included, plus a whole itinerary of fascinating talks and Q&As with a selection of BBC history experts, such as Tracy Borman, Susanna Lipscomb and James Holland. So what are you waiting for? Book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. This Saturday, the 20th of July, marks the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. For today's podcast, we've got an interview with the historian Kendrick Oliver, who wrote a feature on the Apollo 11 mission for the August issue of BBC History magazine. Our World Histories editor, Matt Elton, spoke to Kendrick about the space race that led to the landing in 1969 and its impact back on Earth.
How, looking back now in 2019, should we see the space race? Should we see it as this sort of idealistic aim to get to the moon, or was it grounded in more realistic political concerns, I suppose?
So I think the space race is fundamentally part of the sort of broader Cold War, and I think it's very difficult to disassociate it from that, which is not to say that it doesn't have some sort of independent elements or elements that speak to a sort of wider set of concerns. But I think if you're thinking about why it is that the Americans and the Soviets engage in a competition in space, both in terms of sort of satellites and then manned expeditions and then going on to the moon, it's in many ways a result of military investments, the development of military hardware that make this possible in the first instance. The hardware is being built by companies and institutions that have experience and have developed their expertise developing weapons to be fought, to be used in the Cold War in the sort of worst case scenario. There is a lot of military space activity also going on around the notionally sort of civilian space programs. And of course, the kind of rationales for engaging in the space race are very much related to questions of kind of Cold War prestige. the main reason that John F. Kennedy was interested in going to the moon is not because he had any particular personal interest in space exploration, but he was aware this is one arena where people were looking at, particularly in the kind of newly decolonized or decolonizing areas of the global south, the third world, that they were looking at space exploration and what the Soviets were achieving, and beginning to think that maybe this was a sign that the Soviet model of economic organization and central planning was the way to go. And that was not something that Kennedy was very keen. That was not a lesson that Kennedy was very keen that they should learn. So he wanted to create an image of almost kind of America, of space exploration and the Apollo program as being a sort of sign that the American capitalist system would work even more effectively than the Soviet model.
And this is obviously a period of history that culminates in a man landing on the moon in 1969, but it stretches for quite a long period of history back in time. What can we identify as being some of the most important early events that led up to that final result?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think this perhaps points to that there's what some historians call a sort of long space age, which dates back at least as far as private funding for astronomical observatories in the 19th century. And I think that actually sort of speaks to although we can very much sort of emphasize the kind of Cold War context for space exploration, there are a lot of other things going on, a lot of other kind of cultural and social factors and concerns that shape how people respond to space exploration and going to the moon. There are, for example, concerns growing over the course of the 20th century, or awareness at least going over the 20th century that the sun is going to die eventually, and that therefore there's going to be a need, if the human species is going to continue eventually, to move to some other arena of space. There's a lot of interest in what's called sort of astrofuturism, the idea that you might find somewhere in outer space, a better sort of site for social experiment, that there might be the opportunity to create more ideal societies on a place other than Earth. And there's a lot of interest in the idea that the next frontier, and both the Soviet Union and the United States have long traditions of sort of frontiers, so there's an idea that you would, the next step that one makes as a society is to venture beyond the terrestrial landmass, and given that the kind of Earth is fairly well populated by the mid-20th century, that the next obvious place is to go beyond that. So I think those sort of broader sets of concerns are very much sort of alive, and they sort of surround space exploration as a sort of idea from the mid-century onwards.
Are there then specific moments in the first half of the 20th century that we can pinpoint as being key stepping stones in this process?
All right. So, yes, I mean, I think one of the key things that we need to be aware of is that what helps to create a popular market for space flight by the 1940s and 1950s. Obviously, there are sort of kind of geostrategic rationales, Cold War rationales, but there's also a long popular interest in space flight, space exploration, the question of extraterrestrial life. And so from the late 19th century onwards, and you can think about there are people writing like Jules Verne, there's a growth of interest in science fiction. H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, for example, again. And by the 1920s, both in the Soviet Union, in the United States and elsewhere, there's a growing kind of literature, popular literature in forms of novels, but also comic books, exhibitions. The Soviet Union experiences a sort of space craze in the 1920s. And a lot of the people who subsequently become the sort of pioneers of space exploration, you think about people like Wernher von Braun or Sergei Korolev in the Soviet Union, probably generate, there's some evidence that they are very responsive to these sort of scientific science fiction novels and culture, and it's that that sparks their original interest in the idea of kind of rocketry and space travel. So a lot of the sort of seeds of, as it were, the imaginative seeds for the space age are, you know, take root in the early 20th century, I think.
And how much was the Second World War and its military advancements an important part of this?
So the Second World War is really incredibly important as a sort of a moment that helps to sort of provide the sort of template for what space exploration is going to involve over the course of the next few decades. The principal thing that we need to think about, I think, is the development of the V2 rocket in Nazi Germany. Rocketry was seen by the Nazi regime as something worthy of investment because it wasn't, as a new technology, it wasn't explicitly banned under the Treaty of Versailles, and so the German army was quite interested in the development of rocketry. And by 1942, Wernher von Braun was leading a major organization on to develop an offensive rocket, which at that point was called the A4. And that first took flight in 1942 and really sort of proceeded up to the boundary of space, up into Earth's upper atmosphere. And Wernher von Braun was a space enthusiast. He was interested in rocketry because he was concerned with he was interested in developing the means of space exploration, and service for the German army was, he regarded that as a sort of the price to be paid, or the best, most likely sort of route through to being able to achieve those dreams. So World War II makes it possible, I think, for the V2 rocket to be developed, and really we see a lot of the subsequent technology in terms of rocketry, both in the Soviet Union and the United States, as sort of developing out of the V2 rocket.
And a key next step, of course, was the development of a satellite. Who were the key players in that, and how did that unfold?
Well, that's a really interesting question. The American interest in a satellite had, once the Americans were aware that of the V2 rocket, by the late 1940s, there is some consideration. There are various sort of studies going on within the United States about the possibility of launching an artificial satellite and the purposes that might serve. But they tend to remain on the desk as sort of general sort of studies that people are interested in, without wishing very much to invest large amounts of kind of resource into. That really sort of changes in the mid-1950s as the Americans become more and more concerned about the capacity of the Soviet Union to launch a surprise attack that would affect U.S. soil. And so one of the means by which they start one of the things they start thinking about as a means to prevent that, or at least to detect a surprise attack, but before it becomes a nasty surprise, is by getting surveillance, overhead surveillance of the Soviet Union's territory. And this leads to such things as the U-2 program as well. It's very, very difficult to do by any other means, because you know the Soviet Union is a closed society, and therefore it's not that easy to have people sort of wandering around and having a look at seeing what's going on. And so the other device that they start thinking about is a satellite. But of course, if you launch a satellite and name it as a surveillance satellite, it's more most likely thereafter to get resistance from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union will protest about it. And so what you need to do is cast the first satellite, the precedent-setting device, basically as a scientific device, a peaceful device. And so it's in that context that the Americans in the mid-1950s announce that they're going to launch a scientific satellite in the International Geophysical Year. So it's going to be a sort of satellite that serves scientific purposes. It's going to increase knowledge of the Earth. And the Soviet Union very swiftly follows suit and announces it's going to do the same. And so that's the sort of moment, I think, where you can see both sides are very much invested in V2, in the development of V2 technology into their own kind of rocket series. But it's in the mid-1950s that the idea of the kind of satellite really takes flight in both countries.
And how much of a turning point was the Soviet launch in 1957 of Sputnik?
The Americans very much expected that the Soviets would launch a satellite. The Soviets had indeed announced that they were planning to do so at some time soon on Moscow radio. They announced this was their intention. And so there was already a sort of sense of a kind of competition and a race. And so in many ways, it wasn't a huge surprise that the Soviets got there first. However, what was a surprise, I think, to many people within the American administration was the reaction to Sputnik across the world. It was even a surprise to Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet premier, who thought that the most sort of powerful evidence of Soviet superiority or alleged superiority over Western systems would come as a result of the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And so when he woke up on the morning after the launch of Sputnik and found that all these sort of newspapers around the world were paying attention to Sputnik as sort of evidence of Soviet superiority, or at least a growing Soviet technological advancement, he sort of woke up to this possibility too. And so that sort of sense that Sputnik had shaken up the perception of the relative progress and state of advancement between the two superpowers, I think, came as quite a surprise to the Americans. And it certainly created quite a lot of debate within the administration, within the U.S. Congress, about the need to respond more quickly to this, to sort of accelerate sort of the research and development for American space technology. And one of the problems that they had to encounter was that the first attempt to do this, to launch an American satellite, it blew up on the launch pad on live television, which wasn't a great advertisement for American technological prowess. Just at the moment when the Soviets had repeated the feat of Sputnik with Sputnik 2, launching a dog into orbit.
And it's at this point that NASA becomes a player in this story. I mean, what led to that happening?
So NASA is an interesting creation, because up to the 1957, 1958, when people had been thinking about who was going to be running the space programs, even when they occurred in the United States, they tended to assume that it would be the Air Force, the American Air Force, that it would lie. It would very much be a sort of sphere of military operations. And in many ways, that's something that continue to happen. There is, we shouldn't forget, through the late 1950s and 1960s, a very sizable military space program in the United States. Nevertheless, it was seen as important by members of the Eisenhower administration that the American space program be seen to be different to what the Soviet space program was, that it should have a strong civilian and at least notionally sort of scientific purpose, for various kind of reasons of propaganda. And it's for that reason that NASA was founded as a sort of distinct civilian agency.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
On its own terms, very impressive. But you sort of, I think you have to sort of think about an achievement should have a legacy, and that's where the struggle comes in, I think, a little bit in terms of thinking about the Apollo program.
Time for another quick chat about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you want to get away in 2024, why not book a weekend package at one of Warner's most historic hotels? There's Littlecote House, which is a stunning Tudor manor in Hungerford, Studley Castle, a beautiful 19th century building in Warwickshire, or Home Lacey, a huge Herefordshire mansion that was once visited by Charles I. Whichever location you choose, you'll be able to enjoy a whole weekend of live talks from your favourite historians during your stay. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
So when Kennedy announced that it was his intention to land on the moon within a decade, how likely was it, do you think, that he would succeed?
So NASA had been thinking about the possibility of sending somebody to the moon for a while. Wernher von Braun had, for quite a long time, had been emphasizing this as something that was a natural stage in the kind of progression of man's capability in space. You begin with an unmanned satellite, you go up to a sort of manned Earth orbital mission. Then the idea was that you build a space station, and then after that you would go onto the moon and then on to Mars. So in a way, the idea of going to the moon by that sort of sequence should have happened after the development of a sort of permanent space station. But by the late 1950s, June 1960, NASA is beginning to think this is possible. And it reports in February 1961 that it would be conceivable to get to the moon by the end of the decade, which sort of sets the template, I think, for Kennedy's speech. There's lots of reasons why Kennedy decided to embrace this goal, but at least the fact that the space agency thought that it was possible, he had that in his back pocket. However, we have to remember that there's an enormous amount of work that still had to be done in terms of developing the rocket boosters that would actually be powerful enough to launch whatever hardware you plan to get up, both into Earth orbit and then on to the moon, and also just working out how precisely you would make a landing on the moon, because it wasn't entirely clear what that would involve. Did it mean you would just sort of send a rocket straight up into space and try and sort of fire it all the way to the moon and it would sort of land on the moon's surface and then take off again? Or was there some more kind of complex form of technology involved? So there was a lot of kind of imponderables about how you would do this. And one of the things that Kennedy emphasized in the speech that he made in May 1961 announcing the lunar landing goal was this was going to involve a lot of resources. It was going to involve obviously a lot of money, but it was also going to involve the development of a lot of scientific and technological expertise geared to this goal. And there would be sacrifices in other areas of national life as that sort of scientific and technological expertise focused on these problems. And so we have to be aware, I think, that it wasn't entirely certain how this was going to be done. There was quite a big gamble. Nevertheless, Kennedy had assurances from within NASA that this was that success was indeed conceivable.
And how important do you think him making that statement was in setting the kind of tempo and making this a goal that was being pushed towards?
The speech is really very important, but we have to remember the context in which it takes place, because a president can't, as lots of subsequent presidents have realized, you can't just announce a highly expensive space spectacular and announce that it's going to take place if Congress is not ready to give you the money for it. And so Kennedy's speech falls into a context where Yuri Gagarin has just orbited the Earth. The first manned space flight has just taken place in Vostok 1. The Kennedy administration has just suffered a horrible embarrassment in Cuba with the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. And so there is a sort of deeply unsettled feeling within Washington in early 1961, that once again the Soviets were sort of proving to the Third World that the competition that the Americans thought that they were ahead of in terms of proving the desirability of organizing yourself along a kind of free enterprise line, that was no longer a gimme, and that there were plenty of sort of decolonizing countries in the Third World that might eventually, as a result of looking at Gagarin, looking at the Bay of Pigs and so on, and decide that actually their future lay more with through the adoption of the Soviet model. And so it's not just Kennedy who thinks that. There's quite a lot of people within the U.S. Congress who think that too. And so it's this context that allows Kennedy to get the funding for the Apollo program from 1961, 1962, 1963.
I mean, that's a good point. I mean, for what extent of the space race did it look like the Soviets might win or that the US might not win?
Well, there was a lot of uncertainty. I mean, the one reason why Kennedy and his officials are quite keen on the idea of a lunar landing is because there wasn't a huge amount of evidence that the Soviets had thought about it at that point. So it did seem a sort of opportunity for leapfrogging. You know, if you invest in this... as it were, in a step that's sort of two or three steps ahead of where you might naturally go next, then you have a better chance of achieving that if the other side is still working through methodically the next one or two steps. Nevertheless, for some period of time, the Soviets are still doing they are still achieving a lot of spectacular firsts. So after Gagarin's flight in August 1961, you have cosmonaut Titov spending a day in space, which is, you know, a feat of endurance that the Americans weren't able to catch up with for another couple of years. They launched the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, in June 1963. In October 1964, they launched a three-man crew on a spacecraft. March 1965, Alexei Leonov becomes the first cosmonaut to engage in a space walk. So there's a lot of sort of fairly spectacular achievements taking place within the Soviet program, whereas what the Americans are doing are sort of trying to pace themselves methodically to reaching this kind of lunar goal by the end of the decade. The one thing to remember, I think, though, is that it's what they can benefit from is that the Soviets are a lot of these triumphs are very kind of ad hoc triumphs. They are partly responsive to the need to appease the Kremlin. The Kremlin's got kind of used to having these spectaculars now. And so some of them are to some extent kind of artificial spectaculars. They don't actually point to a very well sequenced and developed space program. It's only in 1964 that the Kremlin really realizes that the Americans are serious about getting to the moon by the end of the decade. And then the Kremlin places some degree of sort of pressure upon Soviet rocketeers to get a circumlunar mission to the moon. That's a mission that would go around the moon, if not land on it, by 1967, which would be the 50th anniversary of the Bolshevik revolution. So there's a sort of mixture of neglect within the Soviet Union, a kind of complacent interest in these space spectaculars. And then suddenly from 1964 onwards, a kind of crash program with a lot of kind of pressure placed upon Soviet rocket engineers to achieve achieve something that would rival the Apollo program.
We've mentioned money a couple of times. How much did the US side of the space race cost? And was there any opposition to this money being spent in this way?
So there's as inevitably, and we know plenty of examples of this, the initial price tag is much less than the eventual price tag. That just seems to be part of the you need a relatively low estimate in order to get people to agree to it. And once they've agreed to it, it becomes easier to kind of increase the costs. And of course, thereafter, once a commitment has been made by the by NASA and by the White House, it becomes a little bit easier for contractors to sort of say, well, if we're really going to do it by that deadline, we need to throw in, you know, we need a little bit more money on the estimates that we provided, you know. And so there's always an increase. So initially, I think the Kennedy administration was thinking this was going to be costing about sort of $7 to $9 billion. It turns out to be closer in the region of 20. And as time goes on, as those costs become clearer and clearer, and as a sense of sort of social crisis begins to affect the United States from the mid-1960s onwards, when you have a whole series of kind of unrest in American cities, you have the Johnson administration of as announcing a war on poverty, which is subsequently partly as a result of primarily as a result of the expenditures on Vietnam, is unable to fund. People start looking at the Apollo program and saying, is this really what we need? Is this the priority for us? There are, of course, lots of people who still think it is and who still think of it as a important venture in Cold War terms and well worth the investment. If you're an aerospace engineer somewhere in California or in Florida, you're making a lot of money out of this. You think this is great. But if you're an African-American living in Harlem and there's a huge degree of kind of deprivation around you, you're much less likely to be a kind of cheerleader for this program. And so by the 1967, 1968, there's a growing sense of sort of opposition. And even within opinion polls, it's actually quite rare from the mid-1960s onwards for there to be majority support for the Apollo program. There's a lot of concern about the costs and whether this is the sort of something that Americans should be prioritizing.
And as we head into 1969, did that skepticism continue, or as it became more and more likely that this is going to happen, did people's views start to change?
So that's a really interesting question, and I think the answer is quite complex. There is, in response, there's a lot of interest in the Apollo 8 mission, which is the first circumlunar manned mission, which occurs in December 1968, with a broadcast back to Earth from the Apollo 3 command module, where they on this kind of broadcast that's listened to by just millions and millions and millions of people around the world on radio and television, they broadcast read out the first 10 verses of Genesis. And this is a kind of fantastic moment in many ways. It's the first words that you can hear back from the shores of another world. It's really spectacular. And you see a sort of bump in support around that time. And as the anticipation rises for Apollo 11, you can see a genuine sense of popular participation and interest in this. I think people are aware that you don't necessarily want to cancel. I mean, as it were, all the costs have been built in to this moment, and you don't want to necessarily kind of cancel. It would be stupid to kind of cancel this just on the kind of eve of the spectacular. So people are sort of aware that the Apollo 11 is coming up, and they're looking forward to it. However, even as Armstrong and Aldrin are making their steps upon the moon, there is quite a lot of opposition still being felt, still being rehearsed in various sectors of the press. And just prior to the launch of Apollo 11, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who's had been until he'd been an associate of Martin Luther King, who'd been assassinated the previous year, led a group of what he called the Poor People's Campaign to the Apollo 11 launch site in Cape Canaveral to protest the expenditure upon the Earth space program, to emphasize that this wasn't the kind of priority, this wasn't the most important thing that Americans should be investing in at this particular moment.
And as we head into the actual mission itself, to what extent did that go to plan?
I don't think anybody expected that it would go entirely to plan, because there are a lot of sort of imponderables and things that you couldn't necessarily test in advance. And one of the certainly things that you couldn't test in advance was using the lunar module actually to land on the surface of the moon. The Apollo 10 mission had detached the lunar module from the command module in lunar orbit, and it had flown relatively close to the moon's surface, and then gone back up to rejoin the command module. And of course, you can't test the lunar module on Earth either, because of the difference between the sort of lunar gravity and Earth's gravity. And so this is a new piece of technology that's being really kind of tested in operation for the very first time. And so I think there are a lot of kind of concerns about this. I can't remember precisely what the chances of success were, but they weren't 100. They certainly weren't perceived as 100%. And so, what happens when the lunar module leaves the command module in in lunar orbit and starts to head down towards the surface of the moon, is that radio contact starts to get a little bit sketchy, and you start getting the landing computer sending program alarms saying it's got too much to do. It's almost got too much information. I mean, the landing computer, you can imagine, is on the lunar module is not terribly well advanced by contemporary standards. So it's got too much to do. It starts sending these alarms, and you have to sort of work out whether these are serious alarms or whether it's something that can just be overridden by Neil Armstrong's piloting. And the other thing that they have to worry about is that as it gets closer to the surface, Armstrong starts to note that the area that he's supposed to land in is sort of festooned with boulders and craters. And so he has to carry on for a while until he can find a sort of flatter and more convenient place to land. All the time, the fuel that they have for making the landing is beginning to run out, and it's that reason. You know, they only have a less than a minute's worth of fuel left. That when they finally make the landing, you have Charlie Duke, who's the CAPCOM, the capsule communicator back in Houston, saying you had a few guys turning blue here. It shows you the level of anxiety that they had about how this could go wrong.
As we know in hindsight, of course, it didn't go wrong. They landed, and it was a kind of a pivotal moment in America's 20th century. But I mean, what, if anything, did it actually gain the US?
That is a sort of super controversial question, and it's something that people are still arguing about. You know, what ultimately was the point of this? Was this as people expected, a kind of a lot of the analogies that were being used around mid-1962 were comparisons to Christopher Columbus. Is this going to be the opening step in a kind of a wide new kind of horizon of possibility? You land on the moon, you start creating a colony on the moon, you practice for going on to Mars, and so on. Or is it more like Leif Erikson? You know, many hundreds of years ago, going on a sort of ship around the to North America and nothing really, you know, creating a settlement there, and nothing really follows as a result of it. And so those, you know, that question about what does it actually give the United States beyond the prestige of doing it? Well, certainly you can count. There's some scientific knowledge that's produced in terms of the nature of the moon, the makeup of the moon. It helps to generate a new understanding of how the moon came to be. There are other sort of spin-offs from the program. I mean, people talk about miniaturization, for example. People talk about Velcro, Teflon, those sort of things. The things that were developed as a result of the Apollo program that might not have been developed anyway. But NASA always found it quite difficult to develop much to sort of sell the spin-offs, really, in terms of generating much enthusiasm for them. It never found there was a huge amount of interest in the scientific payoffs either for the Apollo program. And so I think it is actually quite difficult to judge that this had a that the investment was really worth it. And certainly that's a judgment that's beginning to be made within the Nixon administration. Even as Nixon himself places himself, President Nixon places himself front and center as the astronauts return home. He's on the ship to greet them. He talks to them as they're in their as they're sort of in their sort of site of confinement back on the ship. He's very much sort of front and center of the celebrations that follow, but he's really not that interested in the Apollo program or following it up with any kind of major funded space venture. And so the Apollo program over time just starts to sort of fade away. The sort of later planned missions in the program start to get cancelled. And so, you know, you get six landings on the moon, but nothing else. And there's no colony built. There's no there's no going on to Mars there afterwards in terms of a investment in a manned space program, a more ambitious space program thereafter. So the calculation I think that's being made within the Nixon administration is a political calculation, which is that people have seen the Apollo program, they like the spectacular, they enjoyed Apollo 11, but they're not actually anxious for a repeat.
And what was the reaction in the communist bloc, both at the time and I suppose immediately afterwards?
So the Soviet Union in particular was aware by, certainly after Apollo 8 and probably earlier, that it was not going to win this race to the moon. And so the natural reaction of Soviet officials is to almost pretend that they were never that interested in going to the moon in the first instance. And there's almost a kind of blanket of secrecy that starts to descend over the fact that they had made quite substantial investments in rockets to facilitate a lunar landing. And there's almost a sort of a decade or a couple of decades of kind of secrecy about this. And it's a very much a kind of hidden from view. And so the US, the Soviet Union very much kind of downplays the significance of it. There is a general sort of polite congratulations that are offered to the United States upon this feat. And you can imagine that the Soviet people who have been used to Sputnik, Gagarin, Titov, all the sort of spectaculars of the early 1960s might start wondering whether, you know, what had happened so that the Americans had got there first. And what actually happens in the Soviet Union thereafter is that they start emphasizing instead their capacity for long duration spaceflight. They have developed over the course of the late 1960s the technology of the Soyuz capsule, which becomes really the kind of linchpin of a lot that was to follow in terms of Soviet spaceflight. And indeed, its successors are still in use today. They start building space stations, and you think about the Mir space station, for example, in the 1980s, and so they start arguing on the basis of that they were never very interested in these sort of short-term spectaculars such as the Apollo program. They'd always been building for the long term, and the sort of their successes in terms of long-duration space flight in the 1970s and early 1980s make that a little bit more plausible. But we have to know, you know, now we know that there was an awful lot of effort being put into the attempt to go to the moon and try and beat the Americans. It's just that a kind of blanket, a veil was pulled over that in the wake of the American success.
Do you think their success was the greatest achievement of the 20th century?
Oh God! I mean, I don't know what the greatest achievement of the 20th century was, and I think it's a remarkable achievement given where the Americans were. It took a lot of resources. It took a lot of organization. It's on its own terms very impressive. But you sort of, I think you have to sort of think about an achievement should have a legacy, and that's where the struggle comes in. I think a little bit in terms of thinking about the Apollo program. Undoubtedly, it has legacies. There are scientific trade-offs. There are economic spin-offs. There's a legacy in terms of people citing themselves in relation to this event. If you're looking at a kind of event in which more people than ever before on Earth were looking at their televisions or listening to the radio or standing outside looking at the moon as this event was taking place, this sense of a kind of certainly a national communion, but also a kind of global communion. That's an amazing thing to have created. And perhaps the major sort of legacy of the Apollo program is that sort of memory of that moment when everyone, or at least, you know, a large portion of the world's population stood together and sort of breathed in sync as the Apollo 11 made its way towards the lunar surface. And we have a lot of understandable nostalgia, I think, for that at a moment when society seems quite divisive. There's a lot of emphasis upon narrow casting of just a fragmented audience. You know, these moments seem increasingly rare, perhaps. So I think the sort of legacy of the Apollo program is in that it lies in many ways with that sense of a kind of communal moment. But I wouldn't necessarily count that as being the qualifying it for the status of the most impressive achievement of the 20th century, because the more solid social and economic and political legacies, you know, are not quite there to see in the same way.
Finally, then, given that nostalgia that you just talked about, how would you like people today in 2019 to understand this moment in history differently? Are there things that we should understand about it afresh, do you think?
So when we think about the Apollo 11 moon landing and the broader Apollo program, we have to understand it as being part of a broader society and part of a very kind of complicated and fluctuating context, which is composed in very large measure by the Cold War, by what's happening in terms of the production of military hardware, military space programs, but it's also, and obviously kind of Cold War politics, but it's also affected by some broader ideas about the mortality of the Earth. About, there are some religious ideas that are around that very much kind of influence some people's perceptions of the space program. This is, after all, a venture into the heavens. There are a lot of interest in the idea of how do you perfect human society? Can you do it on Earth, or can you do it? Do you need to travel somewhere else to achieve that? There's a lot of really interesting ideas. I think that the space program stimulates and crystallizes, and I very much would like people to think about the Apollo moon landing as not just one fairly discrete technological feat, but as part of an American society, but also a global society that's in flux, that's full of anxieties as well as aspirations, fears as well as hopes, and and I think we can perhaps, it humanizes the space program if we think about it in these terms. It doesn't seem so remote. It doesn't seem just like a device that's generated from some very, very clever people who are living in Florida or in Houston at a particular sort of moment in time. The space program, the Apollo 11, was a venture that very much kind of belonged to its times, and I think we need to sort of think more generally about the space age and about our own sort of ideas about where we would like to go in space as belonging to us too, and all of us having some degree of kind of agency in directing the human future in space.
That was Kendrick Oliver. You can read Kendrick's feature on the Apollo 11 mission in the August issue of BBC History magazine. For more on the space race, pick up the latest copy of BBC World History's Our Sister magazine. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Monday, when we'll be discussing a major moment in the fight for gay rights, the Stonewall Riots.
Before you go, one final word about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you fancy a break in 2024, you can now choose from three fantastic weekend packages at some of the most historic Warner Hotels. For instance, Littlecote House is set in a stunning location in Hungerford, which has played host to Romans, a Civil War army, and the planning of the D-Day landings. Meanwhile, Studley Castle in Warwickshire was used as a training camp for the Women's Land Army during the World Wars. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.